Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. The PGA Tour season is off and running. National Championship game is on Monday night. My Jags finished their face plant and in the process saved me about $1,000.
Oh, because you didn't have to buy playoff tickets?
TV sitting fees and Rex, our 15 minutes of TV time that we were supposed to share together. The Golf Today roundtable instead just ended up in 30 seconds of bad audio for me. Other than that, how's it going for you?
Went fine for me. I don't even know. You were probably panicky and dealing with technical issues and the fine technical folks at NBC Sports, but I actually threw you under the bus when we came back on today's show.
I heard. I could still hear. Yeah. Apparently, I just couldn't speak well, which is not uncommon.
It's disappointing. Like, just like when Ryan Lavner hangs up on me every time, it's just disappointing. Yeah, I feel for you, but you seem to be having some... Usually, it's me that gets caught with the technical issues. So it is sort of... I do take a perverse pleasure in it. I'm not going to lie. I'm the agent of chaos when it comes to this. When I heard that you were struggling and your sound was bad, I got a grin on the side of my face on live TV. Like, he's coming apart. Fantastic.
I mean, this was still better. We had one of these roundtable things that we're supposed to do now on a weekly basis. So make sure you guys are tuned in from noon to two. It seems like this is going to be an every Monday type of thing. There was a roundtable we're supposed to do. I believe it was in November where... We're probably 30 seconds from showtime, and all of a sudden, my sound dropped. I could not hear host Damon and Eamon. And so, in a not unrealistic possibility, I would be staring at a camera with nothing coming through. I wouldn't know when I'm queued up. I wouldn't know what I'm queued up about, but that was the reality that we're facing. Fortunately, it got fixed with like 5 seconds to go.
There's nothing more terrifying than that.
No,
I can't stress this enough. And I've done some scary things in my life, but hearing programming is what they call it in the biz, and knowing you're about to go up live and then everything goes quiet, even if it's like a pre-planned, okay, we're in commercial break, we'll be right back out. There is still a wave of terror that sweeps over you because you know that, oh, I could be staring blankly into a camera and for a live audience to sit there and be like, look at this fool. How come? Look at this clown. He can't talk. Like, what's happening? It happened to me a few years ago at Torrey Pines to the point that they told our cameraman, John Faco, Rambo, they said, tell him to talk. And Faco's response was, and say what? Like, what am I going to just start doing? Like, Rex, talk to us about the weather. Well, I'm telling you right now, Chris Kirk could sure play. Like, it's just not going to work. Like, you have to be able to have a two-way conversation to do TV.
The weather, obviously, is Burko's lane anyway, and so that would have been already occupied. What we were supposed to talk about, which we did not talk about, which we will now save this Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav, was the first event of the new PGA Tour season, won by Chris Kirk, sixth PGA Tour victory. Go Dogs. It's an incredible Rex recovery story, a redemption story, a player who had clearly lost his way, had even lost his will to live at one point and has come back from the abyss and is now, I would argue, as good as he's ever been, if not better, clearly in a better mental headspace. And Chris Kirk now just has such a great team around him, from his swing coach to his trainer to his performance coach as well. One-shot victory on Sunday, Kapalua over Sahith Theegala, Jordan Spieth in the mix as well. What was your takeaway from the first final round of the new year?
I'd love watching Chris Kirk play golf because nothing's hurried. I think Kisner did a good job of sort of just pointing out that he doesn't rush a swing. He doesn't rush walking to the golf ball. He doesn't rush a putt. Like, it's just, he almost seems like a robot out there, which is interesting because we know that there's a lot of emotion, a lot of things going on internally that I'm sure he's dealing with on his own level. I love the idea. And like, I read the transcript last night and I listened to a lot of the interviews this morning when our colleague Doug Ferguson from the AP asked him specifically about how much longer, when you won the Honda Classic last year, you were Chris Kirk, who overcame alcoholism, comma. I mean, that's always the sort of the second sentence in every story you're going to write about Chris. And he goes, how long should we do that? And Chris's response was, you should always do it. Like, and I love the idea that he embraced this dark times. He embraced all of these demons that you can only imagine sort of haunted him in a way that I talked to his swing coach, Scott Hamilton, who's one of my favorite people on the PGA Tour. And he said that he's been with Chris for a year. And he went through all of this and he goes, I can tell you that we would go to dinner and we would have a beer and we would talk and we'd go our separate ways. It never even dawned on him. Like, it not only was he struggling with this? Like so many other people struggle with this, but he was doing it completely in private. He was doing it in his own shell. He would go back to the hotel room and just drink himself blind. I can only assume, because it's hard to sort of wrap your mind around how bad things had gotten. And I love the idea that he was asked last night after the victory about finding joy again, and whether if that's in playing golf or practicing golf or being around your family or whatever the case may be. And his response was, I find joy in everything now. And it's such a cool story. And to start this year with this story is even more amazing to me, because it could have gone a lot of different ways, it being the first signature event. And to start with him and the way he did it, I think it's a phenomenal tell.
It's a great tone to the new year. It certainly hits back at the theory that the signature events are just going to be about the stars and it's going to kind of get a little bit monotonous. This is a player who hadn't yet secured his spot in the Masters. He finished narrowly missing the Tour Championship. He was still outside the top 50 in the world ranking. Now that checks both of those boxes. But this is a player who he just banked $3.6 million for winning the Century, and yet I guarantee that is of little importance to him. He doesn't necessarily find joy or love the weekly competition. It's the work that goes into it. It's the process that goes into it. It's how difficult it is. It's how it keeps him engaged. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I thought it was a great tone setter. I thought the actual the entire 72-hole competition was really good. And you look at the three players who late Sunday kind of headlined the day. You have Chris Kirk, who was kind of like a metronome, hitting these high swooping draws each and every time with a completely unhurried tempo and rhythm. You had Sahith, rising star on the PGA Tour, first time winner last fall in Napa. He's kind of Rex like a more polished junk man. You remember Freddie Yock back in the day? Like, he was one of my favorite players. It was not aesthetically pleasing, but it was always an adventure to see how he was going to get the ball in the hole. And so Sahith is kind of a more polished version of that. Like, seeing him just kind of unleash on 50, 75 yard fairways, it doesn't always look good. He's not always finishing in balance. The stuff on and around the greens isn't always pretty, and yet he has great hands and really gave it a run, finishing 28 under par. And Jordan Spieth, a player who we talked about on the end of 2023 podcast and the preview podcast for this year as kind of needing to step up. I thought this was a hugely encouraging performance for Jordan Spieth. Led the field in putting, even though he wasn't completely satisfied with the way that he struck the ball at Kapalua.
Well, he got really, I mean, historically unlucky on the 16th. I mean, it was one thing for that ball to go in the bunker, for it to
divots on 15, plug on 16, and a divot on 17.
I mean, and the beauty is, like, and I hate to say this, but it couldn't have happened to a better person. And I'm not wishing bad things on Jordan Spieth at all. I'm wishing that something like this happens on someone that's going to be as outspoken and as honest and just cut the vein open and let the world know exactly. I can't believe the ball ended up there. Like, just the conversations between he and Michael Grella were, I mean, chef's kiss, just perfect stuff. And I will say, and I'm going to do this tonight on Golf Central, and it's the first time I've kind of tried to break down the actual swing.
Lead analyst Rex Hoggard. That's the current state of affairs.
That's right. You and I will be trading that role over the next few weeks. So you guys please tune in. But not a swing person by any stretch of the imagination, but talking with Scott Hamilton, as we mentioned, Chris Kirk's swing coach, he pointed out, and we'll go to the 71st hole and the 5-iron that he hit to 18 inches, whatever the case may be, to essentially win the tournament. I mean, he said it afterwards. It was a shot that he's going to remember for the rest of his career. But walking through that with Scott Hamilton and him explaining that world-class players don't come to a golf ball and think to themselves it could be a 7-iron or a 5-iron. That doesn't happen. You don't have a two-club spread at that level. You and I will, depending on the wind, depending on the shot, depending on how good we feel about our swing, about a million other things will come into it. But tour players don't do that. In that case, it's either a nice, easy 7 or a hard 8. Like, that, those are your two options as a tour player. But he went in his conversation from, okay, I can get a 7-iron there. And I think it was 209 yards, actual. It was like 192 adjusted. It's downhill and the wind and everything else that went into it. And when I asked Scott to actually break down the swing, and he said, well, there's nothing different than he does with everything else. And it's a 2-yard draw. It's a high shot. It's a beautiful shot. Like, if we could all hit it like that, then the game would be much, much easier. He said, the difference is he had to take 1 to 2 miles an hour off it. And I was stunned by that. 1 to 2 miles an hour was the difference between that swing and whatever it is he was going to do with the 7-iron. But it gives you an idea of how precise he is in his swing. He goes, look, pros at that level are all good with off-speed stuff. You have to be to be at that level. None of them, in his opinion, are as good as Chris because his tempo is so good. We sat and marveled at it all week long. We've seen it throughout his entire career. Think about that. He takes 1 mile an hour off his swing speed, which ranges somewhere, you know, upward 114, 115 category. And that's the difference between the shot he hit with the 5-iron versus what he was thinking about for 7-iron. That's artistry.
Is that what you're going with on Central Night? Are you workshopping this?
I was workshopping it. You want
some positive or negative feedback? Do you think we should go back to the drawing board with 2.5 hours go? No, I find that very interesting. And like Chris Kirk is an excellent player. It actually would not surprise me if he contends in a major championship this year. He has a game.
Which one? Anna's going to ask me that tonight on Golf Central. Which one would you say, the Masters?
He seems tailor-made, for the U.S. Open. He continually puts himself in play, and he's just good enough on around the green, Southern guy. He's not going to be befuddled by all of Pinehurst's tips and tricks. I think Chris Kirk, if he were to contend in a major this year, it would be the U.S. Open. Rex, did you miss John Rahm at all, the defending champion at the Century? Yeah. Roy McIlroy wasn't there, of course, as well. So we're missing two of the top three players in the world. But I found myself missing John Rahm. I think anyone who did not miss John Rahm in the season opener is being disingenuous, because the whole point of the signature series on the PGA Tour is to make big events bigger. And the PGA Tour was literally missing the player who just finished third in the tour's own metrics, their own standings for importance to their brand. And so I mentioned it last week on the podcast, but Rahm's absence is underscoring the need for the tour to anoint new stars and to anoint those new stars very quickly. Whether it's Ludvig Aubert, who had a disastrous third round that doomed his week, but Sahith popped up here. Akshay Bhatia was in the final group. Really talented 21-year-old left-hander, tons of game, tons of potential. So the future is there, but the tour really needs them to get to where they want to go, and they need to get them there quickly. Like I'm talking Q1 of 2024.
My middle son was just walking by. I guess he owes you a fantasy football payoff. Is that it? He has to come in here and say something about how bad he is at fantasy football?
I don't know about that. You and I had our own bet as it relates to Georgia football, which you paid off last week.
I paid off. We all pay off.
Band-aid.
Anywho, and I'll answer your question. I will say this, because I actually had to text a friend of mine who's much better at this than I am, because I was curious with Kevin Kisner, because my expectations were so high, because Kevin Kisner ended up doing a breakdown of your boy Bhatia's swing, and I thought it was really, really good. Like, and he did it in sort of that Kevin Kisner way. It's not really technical, but just talking about feels. And if I twisted myself into a pretzel, I probably wouldn't walk the next morning, the whole nine yards. Thought he was really, really good. And look, everyone's going to have their opinion when it comes to Kiz in his first week in the booth. I will say my expectations were so high. It was almost unfair, because I wanted him just not to be good. I wanted him to be great. And I came to realize that, man, it's really, really hard to parachute from your day job, which is trying to play golf as well as you can against the best players in the world, and parachute into a booth and expect, this is just going to be perfect. I'm going to be brilliant right out of the gates. And I guess the idea is, like, next year when Tom Brady goes to the booth for Fox, right? I think he's
allegedly.
Everyone just expects him to be brilliant, and it's just not fair. Like, what in the world would lead you to believe that he's going to be brilliant at that, other than he was a Hall of Fame quarterback? And I would say the same thing about Kevin Kisner. I mean, he's a brilliant player. I love watching him. I love, sort of that scrappy attitude that he brings to the game. But there was nothing innate that would suggest he was going to be good. I think he was very, very good.
He was very, very good. I'm not sure why you're segueing to that, but I do appreciate that. Kevin Kisner is literally doing the dual roles this week. Like, he's playing the Sony Open a week after he was in the booth. He has no intention of surrendering his PGA Tour card. He has full status on the PGA Tour for 2024, but this was clearly a tryout, a three-man booth with Dan Hicks.
Which will make it even better, in my opinion, I guess.
And Kurt Byram. And I thought Kisner was very good as well. I thought he was going to be sharp. I thought he was going to be funny. I thought he was going to be insightful. I thought he was going to be self-deprecating. He was all of those things. Like, I loved how on Saturday when Spieth was lining up a three-footer, he just said, "Jordan, it's 3 feet, knock it in the back of the hole." I thought he was really good on Sunday, observing how Scottie Scheffler's shoulders are open at address for his full swing, which helps his ball striking prowess, but actually hurts him on the greens as well. I think the one thing that Kiz is going to run into trouble with, and it goes back to this dual role, is that he's still very close to these players. And there's going to be a temptation to be a little bit too chummy with players who you're still going to have to see on the driving range 20 times a year. You know, the best analysts, the best broadcasters, you think of Charles Barkley on the TNT set. Like, he's not going back into the locker room after a Lakers loss and facing up LeBron James. It's easier when you're distancing yourself either in the booth or on a set back in Connecticut to just be a little bit more pointed in your commentary. That's no fault of Kizer. That's just the reality of the job. And so I think right now he's best suited as a whole announcer, but I loved him as a broadcaster in general. It's really hard to talk in 10 to 12 second sound bites. But I thought, especially for his first time doing it, like I thought he was excellent. I thought he was excellent, and he should absolutely have a job in TV whenever he wants it.
Well, and I thought about that because you and I have had this conversation. Like, the trick is, not only do you have to understand the game, not only do you have to understand the emotions that players are going through, but you have to know how to work in a really, really small window. And like, I've always used Graham McDowell, and I think you and I both have used Phil Mickelson as examples of players we thought would make the transition well to the booth. I don't know if Phil can talk in a small window. Like, we love to hear him talk when he goes off on one of his rants, but it would be like Padraig Harrington. Like, I adore him when he goes off on one of his rants, but 15 minutes later, you were 18 spots away from where you wanted to be. He would never work in the booth.
Where was I?
Oh, yeah, back to it. But I will say this. At one point, I was watching, and I think this was Saturday, and my wife bunkmate was sitting next to me, and Kisner said something along the lines, 18th fairway at Kapalua. Yeah, you can land a 747 on that fairway, Rolf. And like, even my wife rolled her eyes at that one. And I was kind of like, yeah, he probably needs to avoid those. And trust me, coming from me saying that you need to avoid cliches, I get the irony there. Like, I get caught up in the cliches trying to fill airspace as much as the next person. But in this particular role, I think he'll only get better. To answer your question, absolutely, I miss John Rahm. I think I'm getting more and more to the point where I'm starting to miss all of the stars who want to live golf, because we're being teased with the idea that there is the possibility that we could all come back together, that there could be a day that we would look back on the last 2 years, like, and it was just a bad time. Let's forget about the bad times and let's keep going forward, because this was a really good example. And I think it worked out best for the PGA Tour. I like the fact you had the mix between the star players with Jordan Spieth, with the players who probably you wouldn't consider a star in Chris Kirk and Sahith at this point, at least in his career. I think that's a best case scenario for the tour. But when you look at the product, yeah, I think if John was there and Brooks was there and DJ was there and the rest of them were all together, can you imagine how much better it would have been?
Yeah, I worry for the signature events a little bit, because I think the chief concern is that they can all feel a little bit homogenous, right? It's the same players, but they're not quite the best players because they're still splitting time over on LIV. Most of these tournaments are not going to have a cut. I think we're really going to miss having sort of a match play event this year with the world's best players, or some sort of team event with the world's best players that's not named the President's Cup. And I think when you look specifically at the Century, it's still competing against football. It's still in largely the same TV window. I think for this tournament in particular, I would love to see some sort of, I'm just kind of spitballing here, Pro Bowl or all-star game type aspect to the week at Kapalua. Tuesday and Wednesday, having some sort of like skills competitions or just kind of off-ball stuff, where instead it just feels like a regular 72-hole tournament with very few fans in a tropical paradise. You know what I mean? There's just, it's the same exact formula, same exact concept. They're just plopping down in Hawaii. When I think there's an opportunity when it comes to the 2024 Lid Lifter to just do something a little bit different.
I see what you're saying. I think I compared this to the Pro Bowl when we talked about this last week, because I do like the idea of, and I think it was a historic week for long drives, by the way. I think I probably called it. On day one, there was 69 drives over 400 yards.
Nice.
I think all total, it was like a historic week, certainly for scoring as well. I guess I see where you're coming from. Like, look, Goff is going to do whatever it can to stay out of football shadow, whether if that's the NFL or Saturdays when it comes to football in the South. But it, there's only so much you can do. And unless you're just going to completely write off a 4 to 5 month period, like you're going to have to go head to head with football eventually anyway. And I think this was probably not a terrible scenario, because what you ended up with as almost you had Kapalua leading into, you know, football night in America.
There was an hour window where you could have gone to uninterrupted coverage of the Century on Golf Channel and watched if you want to. I'll be very curious to see if the ratings of a Chris Kirk, if a Sahith, if a Jordan Spieth registered at all with a national TV audience that was obviously glued to their televisions for week 18 of the NFL season. There just has to be another way to still have these tournaments in early January, but not go up directly against football. You can't put it on Monday because the national championship game. I'm not suggesting that.
They should put it on Monday, and I'm like, it's not going to be better tomorrow night.
It used to be the lead into the national championship game, and that didn't really work either. To me, I'm doing it Tuesday through Saturday or Tuesday through Friday. That's how I'm doing these first two events of the season. I might even do the first three or four if you're going to culminate with the Farmers Insurance Open, which obviously has the Saturday finish to avoid going up head-to-head against the NFL's conference championships on that Sunday. Why not shift around the entire makeup of the first month of the season? Try and get as many eyeballs as you can. The fields are actually going to be pretty good. This is the strongest Sony Open field they've had in decades. So you just like to see a little bit more eyeballs on it. Rex, we did have a player of the year vote as broken here first on the Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav. John Rahm was the Golf Writer Association of America player of the year, but the PGA Tour players have spoken and there was an entirely different answer. Scottie Scheffler became the first player since Tiger Woods 2005 to 2007 to win consecutive player of the year awards. Now the tour is not very good at transparency. They only gave Scottie Scheffler's vote total. He had 38% of the vote. In other words, this was an incredibly close race with Victor Hovland and John Rahm, also garnering a lot of the vote. Clearly, I know the tour does not traffic in transparency, but I would have loved to see in this mythical world a pre and post December 7th breakdown. John Rahm went to LIV Golf on December 7th. I would love to see what the percentage of votes were December 1st when voting opened through December 6th. And I would have loved to see the vote totals from December 8th to December 15th when the voting closed. I have to imagine there is a stark difference between those two periods.
I'm so sad your mic went out, because I mean, this was clearly something that had Eamon Lynch fired up on Golf Today this morning, because he actually popped
back. I was screaming. I was screaming and no one could hear me because I want to jump in so badly.
I'm sure your dog and your cat were very impressed. Whatever your hot take was that you couldn't air out, like it just boiling over inside of you because no one else is there to listen. And another thing, Eamon wasn't happy that I didn't come in strong enough. Absolutely, 100%. John Rahm going to LIV Golf impacted the player vote. That being said is, and I think I've talked about this on this podcast back way back in September at Eastlake during the Tour Championship, I did like an informal poll like I do every single year about who should be the player of the year. And most players said that, yes, they understand that John Rahm probably has the better resume. But I was taken by the fact that there was an element of the membership who liked what Scottie Scheffler had done, his historic ball striking numbers, the way he was consistent week in and week out. Now, neither one of them essentially won after the spring, and that factors into the conversation as well. But there was sort of this idea long before the John Rahm to LIV Golf rumor surfaced. So there was already a thought among the players that this could go in Scottie Scheffler's way. I always pop back with the idea that if you just take the names out of it and the faces out of it, and I put these two resumes next to each other, John Rahm should have been the player of the year. Like, it's very, very clear that this conversation should have stopped there. Scottie Scheffler said as much in the Bahamas a few weeks ago. Now, he said as much because he's not the type of person to say he's going to vote for himself, but his point was valid. A major championship counts. And even though Scottie won the Players' Championship, it's not a major. We can have that debate for another day. So I get where there is this idea that maybe it was a popularity vote that went wrong. I'm more upset about Rookie of the Year. Like, look, I'm not taking anything away from
it. You're upset about it.
Sure. I'm not taking anything away from Eric Cole. I think it's a phenomenal story. Like at the Honda Classic, I loved reporting that story as well, because here is a 35-year-old rookie who spent his entire adult life just grinding away, trying to make it to the PGA Tour. That being said, if you were to do exactly what I just told you to do for Player of the Year, and you take the photos and you take the names out of it, and you compare his resume to your boy Aubert's resume, it's not even close. Like, I don't understand that.
I mean, I'm not getting upset with either of these two outcomes.
I'm upset.
And I struggled with our little GWA Player of the Year. Bro. And so I can see how tour players
why did you struggle with it
as well. When you look at the men's Player of the Year and you look at the golf writers, Rahm had 49% of the vote. Victor Hovland actually was second with 33% of the vote. And Scotty earned just 38% of the vote. That's 20 percentage points less than his PGA Tour peers vote him. It's obvious that PGA Tour players value, well, loyalty to the PGA Tour first and foremost. It would be very awkward to see a PGA Tour presentation with Jon Rahm as the PGA Tour Player of the Year if he is no longer, or at least he's suspended by the PGA Tour. But I think they also value consistency. They clearly value statistical excellence. This was the best ball striking season in more than 15 years on the PGA Tour. As it relates to the top rookie, I think there's also, Rex, an appreciation for Eric Cole's story. He played 34, 35, 36 times on the PGA Tour. He had a handful of runner-up finishes. He played well in the spring. He played well in the summer. He played well in the fall. He played well all season long. And there may be a little bit of a hint of competitive jealousy as it relates to Ludvig Aubert. We say it anytime this next big thing pops up on the PGA Tour. Everyone's quick to welcome him. Everyone is kind of awed by their potential and their talent. And then the realization sets in is that this guy is about to kick my butt for the next 10 or 15 years. And there is always a little bit of resentment that pops in to the picture. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but it also wouldn't surprise me if there's a segment of the tour population who thinks that way, in addition to kind of appreciating Eric Cole's journey.
I don't think so. No, I think game can respect game on this front. And I think anyone who watched Aubert,
that game threatens their livelihood. That game threatens the impact they can make in this game.
I'm not going to vote for you because someday you're going to take my job. Like, that's not the way this works. I don't believe that's the way it works.
You just said it's a popularity contest. So if it's a popularity contest, Eric Cole is probably going to win for 2023.
And again, this is the third time I think I've made this take, and I don't want to make it sound like you're right. Eric Cole is an amazing story, and like I'm here for all of it. And I like the fact that he even started playing well at Maui. Like, I love the idea that he's just going to continue to build on what he started last year. Again, after struggling his entire professional life, I just go to the facts. And after Aubert left college, if you look at what he did in a very, very short window, he essentially played his way onto the Ryder Cup. He was a pick, but it was pretty obvious by the end of it that he was going to be on.
But it wasn't necessarily because of his PGA Tour performance. He won the European Masters.
I totally understand that.
World Tour. He blew a bunch of good opportunities that he could have cashed in his first victory on the PGA Tour in the summer. He didn't qualify for the FedEx Cup playoffs. Like, PGA Tour wise, he didn't do a whole lot.
At least that's not true. He finished runner up at the Sanderson Farms. He wins the RSM Classic where he goes head to head with Eric Cole.
I'm saying in the summer when he had the 3 week break where he missed.
But it was all part of the same window.
That's what got him on. That's what got him on the European Ryder Cup team, and then he parlayed that into a very good fall, in which he eventually became a PGA Tour winner.
And that fall should have been part of the voting. As we just pointed out, the voting window was from December 1st to December
15th. It was.
So everything that happened in the fall.
Eric Cole had a runner-up finish in the fall as well. Eric Cole played well for 11 months because that's how long he played on the PGA
Tour. He had a runner-up finish at the RSM Classic to Aubert.
For 5 months.
To Aubert. So I don't know how you can even have this conversation. He played his way into the top 30. You're right. Some of this is what he did in Europe. But just based on what he did on the PGA Tour, should rank him as the Rookie of the Year. Again, I don't know how fired up I really want to get about this, but this
one you're upset. You said you're upset.
Yeah, I'll go with upset. I'll stay with upset.
hopefully something that does not upset you that much is the return of your boy.
My boy.
Rory McIlroy. He begins his 2024 season, not on the PGA Tour, but across the Atlantic in Dubai on the DP World Tour. Rex, it is always an adventure with Rory, where he seems to be as interesting as ever, not just for how he's going to perform inside the ropes, but there's always some sort of melodrama outside the ropes as well. We haven't seen him since he ended the DP World Tour season in Dubai as well. What are your expectations for Rory in 2024?
I mean, same probably as they are every season. I mean, he's a wildly talented player, and I will take it a step further that now that in theory, he doesn't have the distractions of being on the PGA Tour policy board, of being the unofficial spokesman of the PGA Tour against Liv Goff, of seemingly letting go of whatever it is that, you know, that hatred or dislike or discomfort, whatever you want to call it, he had towards the players who joined Liv Goff, as he said in an interview said on a podcast last week, that he has moved on. Like, I think all of those things factor into this, that he's still a talented player. Like, he is still as talented as anyone in the game. And now those distractions are gone. I wouldn't imagine why. And it's been a decade since he's won a major, so that's an entirely different conversation. But I can certainly see him continuing to do what he seems to do every year. And that's win a handful of times and always compete at the major championships and not getting it done in a decade. And all of the things that have made him a special player, I think that only becomes easier this year because he's moved on. I did say in my column on Friday, though, based on what he said in that podcast, Rory, and based on Phil Mickelson's response on social media, and it feels like an intervention where everyone is saying the right thing, but I don't know that everybody believes it.
You don't think he was being genuine while saying that Jon Rahm's move to live was a smart business move? You don't think he was genuine in saying that he was perhaps too judgmental of some players, not all, some players who defected the PGA Tour for Liv Goff? You don't think he was being genuine when he said that Liv Goff exposed some of the PGA Tour's inherent flaws in its model? You think that was all just trying to strike a conciliatory tone without actually meaning it?
I believe he 100% believes that Jon Rahm's move was a business. A smart business move. And I would say the same thing. It was a smart business move for Jon Rahm, and it was a smart business move for the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia because it put them in a better position in a negotiation standpoint. I believe that Rory McIlroy believes that this was better for the PGA Tour because it did expose some of the things that needed to change with the model of the PGA Tour. When it comes to some of the things he has said about those who went to Liv Goff, no, I don't think he believes that. I mean, there is a burning, I don't want to say hatred, but there's clearly a burning dislike between he and many players that went over there. Phil Mickelson being at the top of the list, and we can sit and go through the list of offenses, but in his mind, he's probably saying the right thing because that's what he needs to say right now. As we negotiate, as we get closer to some sort of definitive agreement between the PGA Tour and the PIF, Rory probably needs to come clean and just stay out of it. And this was the best thing he could do. No, I don't think he believes it.
Yeah, I think it's probably time, and he's kind of reading the room and sees that it's time to put our guns down, right? It's time to let the businessmen hammer out a deal, and it's pretty obvious where this thing is headed, and Rory obviously is intimately aware as well since he just resigned from the PGA Tour Policy Board just a couple of months ago. But I also don't think he's kind of blind to the realities of the present. Like, it's pretty obvious these guys are all going to have to get in the same fields anyway, and so not why kind of shift the tone a little bit. I did not, Rex, I'm not sure if you saw Greg Norman's comments in regards to Rory McIlroy's comments, where Greg Norman said that Rory was, quote, falling on his sword. I didn't, if you actually listen to the podcast appearance, that was not at all what Rory was doing here. You know, this wasn't a full capitulation. It wasn't a mea culpa for his role in golf's ongoing civil war. This was more like a personal evolution, where there's more facts have come out, and he kind of wants to be on the right side of history with the landscape that is shifting. All the people who are dunking on him on social media for making kind of a sharp U-turn in regards to his comments, like, it's okay to change your mind. It's showing an open-mindedness. It's showing a thoughtfulness to change your opinion as opposed to stubbornly digging in. You know, the U.S. would not be as much of a mess as it is as a country if we didn't have two sides that were just so deeply entrenched in their two sides. And obviously golf is a microcosm of society at large, where you have PGA Tour stands and you have Live Golf defenders. I think we need more of Rory's open-mindedness, not less of it. Like, he shouldn't be subject to all the abuse that he's been getting on social media from certain sectors.
If you guys had Ryan Lavner going to international politics and towards the back end of the podcast, you guys,
and I'm the most apolitical person ever
Did not see that coming from you. That was a bit of a zig but when facts. I expected but you facts. To zag. I think it facts. Shows a level of maturity. I certainly will say that. And you're right. Given where we are right now in the game, I will still double down on the idea that he, in his heart of hearts, if you asked him when you said that Mexico City, I want to be on the right side of history, he still believes that. I don't think that he has changed his mind that much. He recognizes what's going on in the game, and he recognizes from a business perspective that there's no reason to fight this anymore because it's going to happen. It's inevitable. And the best thing to do right now is to make sure that whatever comes next, whatever the next chapter is, that we're all involved and it's for the best of the game. And I think that's the one realization that he made.
Rex, a couple of other quick hitting items before we get out of here for this week. I thought it was notable. Victor Hovland, after the best year of his career, part of ways with swing coach Joe Mayo. I thought it was notable. Sungjae Im, 34 birdies, setting the new PGA Tour record for a 72-hole competition. I thought it was notable. Gary Woodland, just 4 months after undergoing surgery to remove a brain lesion, will be back in the field this week at Wailea. And I thought it was notable, Rex, these new PGA Tour members. There's some kvetching. There's already some hand-wringing on January 8th with new PGA Tour members who either were promised or thought they would get into the first full field event of the PGA Tour season in 2024 and do not or cannot find a tee time. Of those four stories, which one is most notable to you?
I mean, I'm most looking forward to Gary Woodland. I cannot wait to see him. And it's less than 4 months after having a brain lesion removed, which is an amazing story. I was just texting back and forth with a rep who's worked with him over the last couple of weeks and said, he's swinging it well, still powerful, still hits it a mile. Can't wait to get back out there. That's one of those things. I don't want to move on too quickly because what have you done for me lately mentality. And certainly Chris Kirk winning the Courage Award needs to be celebrated because of everything that he has overcome and everything he's accomplished since overcoming those dark days. That being said, go ahead and pack it up and send it to Gary Woodland, because I truly believe that we should just move it on to Gary Woodland. I'm so impressed with what he's been able to do. The other half of it is, and it is interesting, I don't know who would have promised players either from the middle to towards the back end of the Korn Ferry Tour category and the Q School category that they would get into Q School. I don't believe that. There was a memo sent to all of the players back in November. I reported on it. I wrote about it extensively. And the line in it that everyone shouldn't have glanced over was that there's going to be 10% fewer playing opportunities across the board. If you're not in the top 70, if you're not in that magical signature, if you're not in all the magical signature events, it's going to be 10% less. Just start with that number and work your way backwards. Everyone was told that back in November, long before the Korn Ferry Tour guys decided to show up. Now, the ones that showed up this week in Hawaii to go through orientation and then to find out that they had to go through Monday qualifying, I feel for them, but this is simple math, man. Seven of the signature events this year are going to go to limited field, which means those fields are essentially going to be cut in half. They went from 144 to 70 to 80 or 156 to 70 and 80. You do the math. Like, those are all lost playing opportunities. And the tour is trying to mitigate that by adding a couple starts here and there, but you can only make up so much. And so if you're anywhere outside of that top 70, and that means every category from the top 70 down, you just need to plan on 10% fewer playing opportunities. And given where we are, I don't know why they would be surprised that Sony would be among that 10%. Of course, everyone wants to play Sony.
Yeah. I mean, it sucks for them. Like, you're a newly minted PGA Tour player. You got your card. You're excited and ready to go. And yet you can't get in to a field. I have a hard time mustering up any sort of outrage on January 8th. If we get to the Palm Beach event, if we get to Valspar, if we get to the Nelson, and all of a sudden these players are still finding themselves on the outside looking in for playing opportunities after finishing in the top 30 on the Korn Ferry Tour, yeah, I think there's probably a right and a need to review some of the protocols. But as it pertains to the actual Sony Open week, like, you just listed some of those competing factors. You had guys in the fall who, for the first time in a decade, now didn't have to play in the fall. And so they're itching and ready to go, and they want to see how they perform this year. This was the first time, of course, that the European Tour awarded the top 10 finishers on the Race to Dubai standings who are not otherwise eligible for the PGA Tour. Those guys now have PGA Tour cards. Q School handed out 5 cards for the first time. The Korn Ferry Tour went from 25 to 30, so there's more Korn Ferry guys. And so I think if anything, if you're going to quibble at all with this priority list. It's for the Corn Ferry guys who are second in priority to the European Tour guys. Right, the PGA Tour is prioritizing the top 10 DP World Tour finishers over the top 30 Corn Ferry Tour finishers when those players are supposed to be on the PGA Tour's direct feeder tour. If you're going to quibble with anything, it's that. But again, in early January, I'm not mustering much.
And if you were going to quibble with that, you should have done it way back in the summer or spring of last year when they were first having these conversations. And we knew this was coming. I mean, whatever the numbers are, and I can sit and run you through the numbers. We all knew there were going to be fewer playing opportunities. We all knew, and this actually goes back 2 years now, because I was actually at the Irish Open when they announced that the top 10 players off the DP World Tour would be given PGA Tour cards. And you knew where they were going to be slotted on the priority list. So, no, I don't agree with it. And I can see how the Corn Ferry Tour guys don't like the idea, but this didn't come out of left field. You have seen this coming for almost a year and a half now. So if you were going to have a problem with it, you needed to speak up long before you got on a plane to go to Honolulu.
All right, Rex, this is the final week of the NFL season that just wrapped up. Final Jags party of the year. Certainly we had one at the Lavner household. I made some smash burgers and mushroom poppers, which were a big hit among the crowd. But quite honestly, my liver needs a break, and I'll at least take a break until we get to wild card weekend, some intriguing mashups. And so I must ask, as we now look into the NFL playoffs and the Sony Open, of course, to occupy our primetime hours, what's on the grill?
I don't know what you did. Chili the other day and sent me a snappy chat of it, and it looked really good. So I made it, I think, the next day or Saturday, I guess, when we had all the games going on, and it was unbelievably good. And I have to tell you, the recipe that I found used ground meat as well as hot Italian sausage. And normally the family's not big fans of what I do on the grill, specifically bunkmate. She doesn't really like smoked meat all that much. None of it was left the very next day. Like they inhaled it. So I might do that again if it's going to be cold, because I've discovered
she doesn't like smoked meat. I'm starting to see why she and I tend to butt heads.
And you just tend to see why she doesn't particularly like when I'm on the back porch all day long and come home come inside smelling like smoke with a rack full of something that just burnt smelly meat.
I mean, chili is such like a January meal. It does not like, I know we're about to enter bomb cyclone season for our friends in the Midwest. Like things are going to get pretty sketchy towards the end of the week, particularly in Michigan, but we still get in the 50s and 60s here in Northeast Florida. And so if I can open up the offset and throw a pot of chili in there for 3 hours and get that like smoky film on the top and just kind of like continually reintegrating it into the chili, like it's absolutely delicious. It lasts a couple of days. You throw some mashed potatoes in with it as well. And it is the most delicious comfort food you could possibly imagine.
We use rice. I had never used white rice before. We usually use like macaroni, like elbow noodles or something along those lines.
In your chili.
Yeah, and chili. I think that's more of a New Orleans thing, because that comes from her.
I mean, that sounds like jambalaya, if you're using rice.
Yeah, maybe. But this recipe called for rice. It was very good.
That does sound delicious. I do have a rack of ribs that I'm going to need to throw on the smoker on
pork
Saturday
or
Sunday as well. Pork ribs. Beef ribs take a long time, and at least I have not found in Northeast Florida a good butcher shop to get beef ribs from. If you do not get high-quality meat, those can be really tough and really disgusting. They can be really fatty and not all that appetizing to consume. Make sure you guys check us out on the TikTok. We'll have some cooking videos on there as well. In addition, the podcast clips and anything else. Rex, I know you were going to be having some trips to Connecticut, so I'll be looking forward to some behind-the-scenes footage as well. You and I will both be pinch-hitting. How about this for a state of affairs? You and I will both be pinch-hitting as co-hosts on Golf Today over the first 2 months of the year. Not together. The FCC would have needed advance notice if they were going to put you and I together on the same set as co-hosts, but hopefully in the summer, probably during a holiday week, you and I, I'm sure, will get the opportunity to do so. But I'm sure you're looking forward to that. I believe that begins Torrey Pines week, so guys, make sure you check on that. And Rex and I will also be on Golf Today for our weekly spots. All right, let's go do it for this edition. Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. Make sure you guys go to nbcsports.com/golf the rest of the week for news, notes, updates from the Sony Open, whatever else happens in the world of golf. We'll be back next week for a full recap of the Sony, first week of the playoffs, and of course, what we threw on the grill as well. Hope you guys have a great rest of the week. We'll talk to you then.
Congrats, Bills by a billion.